motioned to one opposite him. "The light shine on you, Lord Dobrain." If the man wanted to be formal, Perrin could be formal, but there were limits. "Whatever you have to say, my wife can hear. I keep no secrets from her. And Loyal is my friend." He could feel Fael's gaze on him. The sudden scent of her nearly overpowered him. For some reason, he associated that with her loving him. When she was at her tenderest, or when her kisses were fiercest, that aroma almost overwhelmed him. He thought about telling Dobrain to go, and Loyal and Sulin, too. If Fael smelled that way, surely he could make it all right somehow. But the Kyrian was already sitting. "A man who has a wife he can trust, Lord Ibarra, is favored of grace beyond wealth." Still Dobrain eyed her for a moment before going on. "Today, Kyrian has suffered two misfortunes. This morning Lord Maringill was found dead in his bed, of poison, it appears. And only a short while later, High Lord Mylan apparently fell victim to a footpad's blades in the streets. Most unusual during the Feast of Lights." "Why are you telling me this?" Perrin said slowly. Dobrain spread his hands. "You are the Lord Dragon's friend, and he is not here." He hesitated, and when he went on, it seemed he was forcing words. "Last night, Kolaver dined with guests from a number of the smaller houses. Dagunred, Chiliandred, Annalyn, Wasielen, others. Small by themselves, but numerous. The subject was alliance with House Sagon, and support for Kolaver for the Sun Throne. She made little effort to hide the meeting." Again he paused, weighing Perrin with his eyes. Whatever Dobrain saw, he seemed to think it called for more explanation. "This is most strange, because both Maringill and Mylan wanted the throne, and either would have had her smothered with her own pillows had they learned of it." At last Perrin understood, though not why the man needed to beat around the bush so. He wished Fael would speak up. She was so much better at this sort of thing than he. From the corner of his eye he could see her, head bent over the stones board and watching him from the corner of her eye. "If you think Kolaver committed a crime, Lord Dobrain, you should go to Ruark." He had been going to say Berelane, but even so, the threat of jealousy increased slightly in Fael's scent.
"The Aiel savage," Dobrain snorted. "Better to go to Berelane, and that not much. I admit the Mayenner wench knows how to order a city, but she thinks every day is the Feast of Lights. Kolaver will have her sliced and cooked with peppers. You are the Dragon Reborn's friend. Kolaver..."
This time he stopped because he finally realized that Berelane had entered the room without knocking. Something long and narrow and wrapped in a blanket, cradled in her arms. Perrin had heard the door latch click, and at the sight of her, with half her bosom exposed, fury almost washed everything else out of his head. The woman came here to carry on her flirting in front of his wife? Rage drove him to his feet, and his hands slapped together with a thunder crack.
"Out! Out, woman! Out now, or I will throw you out, and I will throw you so far you bounce twice!"
Berelane gave a start at his first shout, then dropped her burden and took a wide-eyed step back, although she did not leave. By the last word, Perrin realized that everyone was looking at him. Dobrain's face appeared impassive, but his scent was all astonishment, like one tall stone spike in the middle of a flat plain. Loyal's ears were as stiffly erect as that spike, and his jaw on his chest. And Fael, wearing that cool smile, Perrin did not understand at all. He expected the waves of jealousy, with Berelane right there in the room, but why did she smell just as strongly of hurt? Suddenly Perrin saw what Berelane had dropped. The blanket had fallen away to reveal Rand's sword, and the belt with the dragon buckle. Would Rand have left that behind? Perrin liked to think things through. When you were hasty, you could hurt people without meaning to. But that sword lying there was like a strike of lightning. Fast was foolish and sloppy in forge work, but Perrin's hackles rose and a growl rumbled deep in his throat.
"They have taken him!"
Sulin wailed suddenly, shockingly. Head thrown back, eyes squeezed shut, she moaned at the ceiling, and the sound of her voice was enough to make Perrin shiver.
"The Aes Sedai have taken my first brother!"
Her cheeks glistened with tears. "Be calm, good woman," Verlaine said firmly. "Go into the next room and be calm." To Perrin and Dobrain she added, "We cannot allow her to spread word."
"You do not recognize me," Sulin broke in savagely, "wearing this dress and with my hair grown longer. Speak of me again as though I am not here, and I will give you what I hear Ruark gave you in the Stone of Tyr, and should have since."
Perrin exchanged confused glances with Dobrain and Loyal, even with Fael before her eyes jerked away. Verlaine, on the other hand, went pale and crimson by turns. Her scent was pure mortification, shriveled and small. Striding to the door, Sulin had flung it open before anyone could move. Dobrain at least started to, but a yellow-haired young maiden passing by saw her and grinned in amusement.
"Wipe your face, Luwain!" Sulin snapped.
Her hands seemed to be moving, hidden from the room by her body. Luwain's grin was indeed wiped away.
"Tell Nandera she must come here at once, and Ruark! And bring me cut and sore, and scissors to cut my hair properly. Run, woman! Are you Fardarais Mai, or Cheyenne Matal?"
The yellow-haired maiden darted away, and Sulin turned back to the room with a satisfied nod, slamming the door. Fael was gaping.
"Grace favors us," Dobrain growled. "She told the Aiel nothing. The woman must be mad. We can decide what to tell them after we tie and gag her."
He moved as if to do it, even pulling a dark green scarf from his coat pocket, but Perrin caught his arm.
"She is Aiel, Dobrain," Verlaine said, "a maiden of the spear. I do not understand the livery."
Surprisingly, it was Verlaine who received a warning glare from Sulin. Perrin exhaled slowly, and he had wanted to protect the white-haired old woman from Dobrain. The Kyrianen looked at him questioningly, raised the hand holding the scarf a little. Apparently he still favored binding and gagging. Perrin stepped between the two and picked up Rand's sword.
"I want to be sure."
Suddenly he realized his steps had put him very close to Verlaine. She glanced at Sulin uneasily and moved closer to him as though seeking protection, but her scent was determined, not uneasy. She smelled like a hunter.
"I don't like leaping to conclusions," he said,
walking over to stand beside Fael's chair. Not quickly, just a man going to stand by his wife.
"This sword isn't really proof of anything."
Fael rose and glided around the table to peer at the board past Loyal's shoulder. Well, closer to his elbow, really. Verlaine glided, too, toward Perrin. She was still chasing fearful looks at Sulin without the slightest fear scent, and her hand came up as if to take his arm. He moved after Fael, trying to appear casual.
"Rand said three Aes Sedai could not harm him if he was watchful."
Fael sailed around the other side of the table back to her chair.
"I understand he never let more than three near him."
Verlaine followed with piteous looks for him, and plainly fearful ones for Sulin.
"I was told only three came here the day he left."
He went after Fael a little faster. She popped out of her chair again, returning to Loyal's side. Loyal had his head in his hands and was moaning, softly for an Ogier. Verlaine stalked after Perrin with her already big eyes wide, the very picture of a woman seeking protection. Light she smelled determined. Whirling to face her, Perrin shoved stiffened fingers against her chest hard enough to make her squeak.
"Stop right there!"
Abruptly he realized exactly where his fingers were nestled and snatched them away as if burned. He managed to keep his voice hard, though.
"Stay right there!"
He backed away from her, glaring hard enough to crack a stone wall. He could understand why Fael's jealousy was a cloud filling his nose, but why did she smell even more hurt than before?
"Few men can make me obey," Verlaine laughed softly, "but I think you are one."
Her face and tone, and more importantly her scent, became serious.
"I went searching in the Lord Dragon's apartments because I was afraid. Everyone knew the Aes Sedai had come to escort him to Tarvalen, and I could not understand why they had given up. I myself received no fewer than 10 visits from various sisters advising me on what I should do when he returned to the tower with them. They seemed very certain."
She hesitated, and though she did not look at Fael, Perrin got the impression she was considering whether to say something in front of her. In front of Dobrain as well, but more Fael. The hunter smell returned.
"I received the strong impression that I should return to Mayenne, and that if I did not, I might well be escorted there."
Sulan muttered under her breath, but Perrin's ears heard clearly.
"Ruark is a fool. If she was truly his daughter, he would have no time to do anything else for having to beat her."
10, Dobrain said. "I had only one visit. I thought she was disappointed when I made it clear I had sworn fealty to the Lord Dragon. But whether 10 or 1, Kolaver is the key. She knows as well as any that the Lord Dragon means the Sun Throne for Elaine Trakand."
He grimaced. "Elaine Damodred. She should be. Tarangale should have insisted Morghese marry into Damodred instead of marrying into Trakand himself. She needed him enough to have done it. Well, Elaine Trakand or Elaine Damodred, she has as strong a claim to the throne as any, stronger than Kolaver's by far. Yet I am convinced Kolaver had Maringill and Mylan killed to make her own way to the throne safe. She would never have dared had she thought the Lord Dragon would ever return."
"So that is why."
A small, vexed frown creased Berylaine's forehead.
"I have proof she had a servant put poison in Maringill's wine. She was careless, and I brought 2 good thief-catchers with me. But I did not know why."
She bowed her head slightly, acknowledging Dobrain's admiring look.
"She will hang for that, if there is any way to get the Lord Dragon back. If not, I fear we must all look to how we are to stay alive."
Perrin's hand tightened on the boarhide scabbard.
"I will get him back," he growled.
Danil and the other 2 Rivers men could not be more than halfway to Cairhien yet, burdened with the wagons. But there were the wolves.
"If I have to go alone, I'll get him back."
"Not alone,"
Loyal said, as grimly as stone grinding.
"Never alone while I am here, Perrin."
Abruptly his ears shifted in embarrassment. He always seemed embarrassed when anyone saw him being brave.
"After all, my book will not end very well if Rand is imprisoned in the tower, and I can hardly write of his rescue if I am not there."
"You will not go alone, Ogier," Dobrain said. "I can have 500 men I trust by tomorrow. What we can do against 6 Aes Sedai I do not know, but I keep my oaths."
Looking at Sulan, he fingered the scarf that he still held.
"But how far can we trust the savages?"
"How far can we trust tree killers?"
Surly demanded in a voice leathery and tough as she herself, striding in without knocking. A grim-smelling Ruark was with her, and Amis, her 2 youthful face cool as any Aes Sedai's in that incongruous frame of white hair, and Nandera, reeking of murderous fury and carrying a bundle of gray and brown and green.
"You know?" Perrin said incredulously.
Nandera tossed the bundle at Sulan.
"Past time you saw your toe as met. Almost 4.5 weeks? An entire month and a half? Even Guy Shine say your pride is too strong."
The 2 women vanished into the bedchamber. A smell of irritation had wafted from Fael as soon as Perrin spoke.
"Maiden hand talk," she murmured, too softly for any ear but his to hear.
He gave her a grateful look, but she appeared to be concentrating on the stones board.
Why was she not taking part? She gave good advice, and he would be grateful for any she was willing to offer.
She placed a stone and frowned at Loyal, who was intent on Perrin and the others. Trying not to sigh, Perrin said flatly,
"I don't care who trusts who. Ruark, are you willing to send your Aiel against Aes Sedai? 6 of them?
100,000 Aiel would give them pause, though. The number coming out of his mouth made him blink. 10,000 men was not an inconsiderable army, but those were the numbers Rand had spoken of, and what Perrin had seen of the Aiel camp in the hills made him believe. To his surprise, Ruark smelled hesitant.
"So many are not possible," the clan chief said slowly, and paused before going on. "Runners came this morning. The Shido are moving south from Kinslayer's Dagger in force into the heart of Kyrian. I may have enough to stop them. They do not all seem to be coming. But if I take so many spears out of this land, all that we have done will have to be redone. At the least, the Shido will have looted this city long before we return. Who can say how far they will have gone, into other lands even, and how many carried off claiming they are Gaishan?" A strong odor of contempt came from him at that last, but Perrin understood none of it. What did it matter how much land had to be reconquered, or even how many people died, though that thought came reluctantly, painfully, stacked against Rand, the dragon reborn, being taken prisoner to Tarvalin? Soralea had been studying Perrin. Wise One's eyes often made Perrin feel as Aes Sedai's did, that he had been weighed to the ounce and measured to the inch. Soralea made him feel he had been disassembled like a broken plow, every pin hefted and examined to see whether it should be mended or replaced.
"Tell him everything, Ruark," she said sharply.
Amys laid a hand on Ruark's arm.
"He has the right to know, shade of my heart. He is Randolph Thor's near brother."
Her voice was gentle, her smell quite firm. Ruark gave the Wise Ones a hard look, and Dobrain a contemptuous one. Finally he straightened to his full height.
"I can take only maidens and Siswayaman."
By his tone and his smell, he would rather lose an arm than speak those words.
"Too many of the others will not dance the spears with Aes Sedai."
Dobrain's lip curled in contempt. "How many Kyrianen will fight Aes Sedai?" Perrin asked quietly.
6 Aes Sedai. And we have nothing but steel.
How many of the maidens and these sis-whatever could Ruark gather? No matter. There were always the wolves. How many wolves would die? The curl went out of Dobrain's lip.
"I will, Lord Ebarra," he said stiffly. "I and my 500. If there were 60 Aes Sedai."
Even Soralea's cackle was leathery.
"Do not fear the Aes Sedai, tree killer."
Suddenly, shockingly, a tiny flame danced in the air before her. She could channel. She let the flame vanish as they began planning, but it remained in Perrin's thoughts. Small, flickering weakly, somehow it had seemed a declaration of war stronger than trumpets. War to the knife.
"If you cooperate," Galena said conversationally, "life will be more pleasant for you." The girl stared back sullenly and shifted on her stool, a little painfully yet. She was sweating freely, though her coat was off. The tent must be hot. Galena sometimes forgot temperature altogether. Not for the first time she wondered about this Min, or El Mindreda, or whatever her real name was. The first time Galena had seen her, she'd been garbed like a boy, keeping company with Nynaeve Almira and Egwene Alvir, and Elaine Trakand as well, but the other two were tied to Al'Thor. The second time El Mindreda had been the sort of woman Galena hated, frilly and sighing, and as near under the personal protection of Swan Sanchez made no difference. How Elida had ever been fool enough to allow her to leave the tower, Galena could not imagine. What knowledge was in this girl's head? Perhaps Elida would not have her right away. Properly used in the tower, the girl might enable Galena to net Elida like a swallow. For all of Alviarin, Elida had become one of those strong, capable Amerlins who took every rein firmly into their own hands. Caging her would surely weaken Alviarin. Properly used right now. A change in the flows she had been sensing made Galena sit up straight. I will talk with you again when you have had time for thought, Min. Think carefully on how many tears a man is worth. Once outside, Galena snapped at the stocky warder on guard. Watch her properly this time. Carillo had not been on guard during the incident last night, but there was too much mollycoddling of the Gaidin. If they had to exist at all, they should be treated as soldiers and no more. Ignoring his bow, she glided away from the tent, looking for Gawain. That young man had been withdrawn since Althor was captured, and much too quiet. She was not about to have everything ruined by him trying to avenge his mother. But she saw Gawain sitting his horse on the edge of the camp, talking to a knot of those boys who called themselves the Younglings. They had stopped early of necessity today, and the afternoon sun made long shadows of the tents and wagons beside the road. Rolling plains and low hills surrounded the camp, with only a few scattered thickets in sight, most sparse and small. 33 Aes Sedai with their servants and warders. 9 were green, only 13 red, and the rest white. Alviarin's former Aja made a considerable encampment even without counting Gawain and his soldiers. A number of sisters were standing outside or looking out of their tents, having felt what Galena had. The focus of attention was 7 Aes Sedai, 6 seated on stools around a brass-bound chest, set where it could catch whatever strength remained in the sun. The 7th was Arian. She had not been far from the chest since Althor was put back into it last night. He had been allowed out once they were away from Cairhien, but Galena suspected Arian was going to want him to make the rest of the journey inside that box. The green rounded on her as soon as she came close. Arian was quite beautiful usually, her face a pale, exquisite oval, but now crimson suffused her cheeks, as it had almost constantly since the night before. And her lovely dark eyes were red-rimmed. He did try to break through the shield again, Galena. Wrath mingled with contempt for the man's foolishness, making her voice thick and harsh. He must be punished again. I do want to be the one to punish him. Galena hesitated. Much better would be to punish Min. That would quell Althor. He had certainly raged enough seeing her punished for her outburst last night, which had in turn come from seeing him punished. The entire incident had begun because Althor discovered Min was in the camp after one of the warders carelessly allowed her to walk in the darkness instead of keeping her closely confined in her tent. Who would have thought that Althor, shielded and surrounded, would have gone mad that way? Not just trying to break through the shield, but killing a warder with his bare hands and severely wounding another with the dead man's sword, to such an extent that the second died in the healing. All that in the moments required for the sisters to overcome their shock and bind him with the power. For herself, Galena would have gathered the other red sisters and gentled Althor days ago. Since that was prohibited, she would just as soon have delivered him to the tower unmarked, so long as he was reasonably polite. Even now, efficiency was what she cared for, and what would be efficient would be to bring Min out here and let him hear her wail and weep again, let him know that he was the cause of her pain. But by chance, both the dead warders belonged to Arian. Most of the sisters would feel she had the right. And Galena herself wanted the doll-like gleaner green to rid herself of her rage as soon as possible. Much better to travel the rest of the way, able to admire that porcelain face unruffled. Galena nodded.
Rand blinked when light suddenly flooded into the chest. He could not help flinching, too. He knew it was coming. Luce Theron fell silent and still. Rand held the void by a fingernail, yet he was all too aware of cramped muscles groaning as he was pulled upright. He clamped his teeth shut and tried not to squint against what seemed the brightness of noon. The air seemed wonderfully fresh. His sodden shirt clung to him, dripping with sweat. No cords held him, but he could not have moved a step for his life. If not held up with the power, he would have fallen over. Until he saw how low the sun sat, he had no idea how long he had been in there with his head between his knees, in a puddle of his own sweat. The son got only a notice, though. Involuntarily, his eyes went to Arion, even before she placed herself squarely in front of him. The short, slender woman peered up at him, dark eyes full of fury, and he almost flinched again. Unlike last night, she said nothing, only began. The first unseen blow struck him across the shoulders, the second, the chest, third, the backs of his thighs. The void shattered. Air. Only air. It sounded softer that way. Each blow felt like a whip, though, wielded by an arm stronger than any man's. Before she began, bruised welts crisscrossed him from shoulders to knees. He had been aware of them, not so dimly as he could have wished. Even inside the void he had wanted to weep. After the void went, he wanted to howl. Instead, he clenched his jaws. Sometimes a grunt escaped through his teeth, and when one did, Arion's efforts redoubled as if she wanted more. He refused to give it. He could not stop a shudder at each stroke of that invisible lash, but no more than that would he give her. He fixed his eyes on hers, refused to look away, to blink.
"I killed my Elena,"
Luz Theron moaned every time a blow landed. Rand had his own litany, pain flailing his chest. "This comes of trusting Aes Sedai." Fire striping his back. "Never again. Not an inch, not a hair." Like a razor's slash. "This comes of trusting Aes Sedai." They thought they could break him. They thought they could make him crawl to Elida. He made himself do the hardest thing he had ever done in his life. He smiled. Certainly it touched nothing but his lips, yet he looked Arion in the eye, and he smiled. Her eyes widened, and she hissed. The scourges began to come from everywhere at once. The world was pain and fire. He could not see, only feel. Agony and inferno. For some reason he was aware of his hands trembling uncontrollably in their invisible bonds, but he concentrated on holding his teeth shut. "This comes of... won't cry out. I will not cry out. Never again. Not an in... not an inch. Not a hair. Never again. I will not. Never a... never, never, never." First there was a perception of breathing. Air gulped hungrily through his nostrils. He throbbed, he was a pulsing flame, but the beating had stopped. It almost came as a shock, realizing that. The end of something that part of him had been convinced would never end. He tasted blood and realized that his jaws hurt almost as much as the rest of him. Good. He had not cried out. The muscles of his face were locked in a knotted cramp. It would take effort to open his mouth, even if he wanted to. Sight was the last thing to return, and when it did, he wondered whether pain was making him hallucinate. Among the Aes Sedai stood a group of wise ones, shifting their shawls and staring at the Aes Sedai with all the arrogance they could muster. When he decided they were real, unless he was fantasizing Galena talking to one of his fancies, his first thought was rescue. Somehow the wise ones had... it was impossible, but somehow they would... Then he recognized the woman speaking with Galena. Savanna strolled toward him, a smile on that plump, greedy mouth. Those pale green eyes peered up at him from that beautiful face framed by hair like spun gold. Rand would as soon have looked into the face of a rabid wolf. There was something odd in the way she stood, leaning forward slightly, shoulders back. She was watching his eyes. Abruptly, as much as he hurt, he wanted to laugh. He would have, if he could have been sure what sound would emerge if he opened his mouth. Here he was, a prisoner, beaten within an inch of his life, welts burning, sweat stinging, and a woman who hated him, he was sure, who probably blamed him for the death of her lover, was trying to see whether he would look down the front of her blouse. Slowly she ran a fingernail across his throat. in fact, as far around his neck as she could reach, as though imagining cutting off his head. Fitting, considering Culloden's fate.
"I have seen him," she said with a satisfied sigh, and a small shiver of pleasure. "You have kept your part of the bargain, and I have kept mine."
The Aes Sedai doubled him again then, shoved him back down into the chest with his head between his knees, crouching in that thin puddle of sweat. The lid closed, and darkness enclosed him. Only then did he work his jaws until his mouth could open and let out a long, shuddering breath. He had not been sure whether he might not whimper even now. Light, but he was on fire. What was Savannah doing here? What bargain? No. All very well to know there was some bargain between the tower and the Shido, but worrying about it was for later. Now was for Min. He had to get free. They had hurt her. That thought was so grim it almost dulled the pain. Almost. Assuming the void again was a labor of wading through a swamp of agony, but at last he was surrounded by emptiness, reaching out towards Aydin. Only to find Luz Theron there as soon as he was, like two sets of hands fumbling to grasp something only one could hold.
"Burn you," Rand growled in his head. "Burn you, if you'd only work with me, just once instead of against me." "You work with me," Luz Theron snapped back.
Rand nearly lost the void in shock. There could be no mistake this time. Luz Theron had heard him and answered.
"We could work together, Luz Theron."
He did not want to work with the man. He wanted him out of his head. But there was Min, and how many days yet to Tarvalin? Somehow he was sure if they got him that far, there would be no more chances. Ever. An uncertain, apprehensive laugh answered him. Then,
"Together."
Another laugh, and this mad as a loon.
"Together, whoever you are."
And voice and presence vanished. Rand shivered. Kneeling there, adding more sweat to the puddle his head rested in, he shivered. Slowly he reached for Sidene again, and came against the shield, of course. The thing he had been seeking in any case. Slowly, ever so gently, he felt his way along it, to where a hard plane suddenly turned to six soft points.
"Soft," Luz Theron said, panting. "Because they are there, sustaining the buffer. Hard when they're not. Nothing to be done when they are soft, but I can unravel the web if they knot it. With time."
He paused so long, Rand thought he was gone again. Then he whispered,
"Are you real?"
And then he really was gone. Gingerly, Rand felt along the shield to the soft points. To six Aes Sedai. With time? If they tied it, which they had not so far in, what was it, 6 days, seven, eight? No matter. He could not afford to wait too long. Every day was one closer to Tarvalin. Tomorrow he would try to break through the barrier again. It had been like beating his hands against stone, but he had beaten with all his strength. Tomorrow, when Arian flogged him, he was sure it would be her, he would smile at her again, and when the pain built, he would let the screams come. The next day, he would not more than brush the shield, maybe hard enough to let them feel it, but only that, and not again after, whether they punished him or not. Maybe he would beg for water. They would give him some at dawn, but he was thirsty again. Even if they let him drink more than once a day, begging would fit. If he was still in the box then, he might plead to be let out, too. He thought he would be. Small chance of them allowing him out for long, until they were sure he had learned his lesson. Cramped muscles twitched at the thought of 2 or 3 more days stuffed in here. There was no room to move anything, but his body tried. 2 or 3 days, and they would be sure he was broken. He would look fearful and avoid meeting anyone's gaze. A wretch they could safely let out of the chest. More importantly, a wretch they did not need to guard so closely. And then, perhaps, they would decide they did not need 6 to hold the shield, or that they could tie it off, or something. He needed some crack. Something. It was a desperate thought, but he realized that he was laughing, and he could not stop. He could not stop feeling at the barrier, either. A blind man sliding his fingers desperately across a piece of smooth glass.
Galena frowned after the departing Aiel women until they topped a rise and vanished down the other side. Every one of those women except Savannah herself had been able to channel, several quite strongly. No doubt Savannah had thought herself safer surrounded by a dozen or so wilders. Amusing thought. These savages were an untrusting lot. In a few days she would make use of them again, in the second part of Savannah's bargain. The regrettable death of Gawain Trakand and the better part of his younglings. Returning to the heart of the camp, she found Arion still standing over the chest containing Althor. "He do be weeping, Galena," she said fiercely. "Can you hear him? He do be..." Suddenly tears were sliding down Arion's face. She simply stood there sobbing quietly, her hands fists clutching her skirts. "Come to my tent," Galena said soothingly. "I have some nice blueberry tea, and I will put a cool, damp cloth on your brow." Arion smiled through her tears. "Thank you, Galena, but I cannot. Roshan and Bartol will be waiting for me. They do suffer worse than I fear. They do not only feel my suffering, but do suffer because they know I do. I must comfort them." One grateful squeeze of Galena's hand, and she glided away. Galena frowned at the chest. Althor did seem to be weeping. Either that or he was laughing, and she very much doubted that. She looked after Arion, just disappearing into her warder's tent. Althor would weep. They had at least 2 weeks more to Tar Valon and Elida's planned triumphal entry. Yes, at least 20 days more. From now on, whether Arion wished to do it or not, he was to be punished each day at dawn and at sunset. When she brought him into the White Tower, he would kiss Elida's ring, speak when spoken to, and kneel in the corner when he was not wanted. Eyes tight, she went to drink her blueberry tea by herself. As they entered the largish stand of trees, Savannah turned to the others, thinking how remarkable it was that she should think of the trees so casually. Before crossing the dragon wall, she had never seen so many trees. "Did you all see the means they used to hold him?" she asked, making it sound as if she had said, "also," instead of "all." Therava looked at the others, who nodded. "We can weave all they have done," Therava said. Nodding, Savannah fingered the small stone cube with its intricate carvings in her pouch. The strange wetlander who had given it to her had said she should use it now, when Althor was captive. Until she had actually looked on him, she had intended to. Now she decided to throw the cube away. She was the widow of a chief who had been to Roydian, and of a man who had been called chief without making that visit. Now she was going to be the wife of the Karakarn himself. Every spear of the Aiel would be grounded to her. Her finger still retained the feel of Althor's neck, where she had traced the line of the collar she would put on him. "It is time, Dessein," she said. Of course, Dessein blinked in surprise, and then she had time only to scream before the others began their work. Dessein had contented herself with grumbling about Savannah's position. Savannah had put her time to better use. Except for Dessein, every woman here was solidly behind her, and more besides. Savannah watched very closely what the other wise ones did. The one power fascinated her, all those things done so miraculously, so effortlessly, and it was very important that it would be seen that what was done to Desaigne could only have been done with the power. She thought it quite astounding that a human body could be taken apart with so little blood.
Chapter 54. The Sending. With the sun just a thin glowing slice on the horizon, the second day of the Feast of Lights saw the streets of Carrion already filled with revelers. Indeed, they had never really emptied through the night. There was a frenzied air to the celebration, and few gave more than a glance to the curly bearded man, with the grim face and axe on his hip, riding a tall bay down the arrow-straight streets toward the river. Some did look at his companions. An Aielman was a common enough sight now, though they had abandoned the streets when the celebrations began. But it was not every day that you saw an Ogier, taller than the man on horseback, especially one carrying an axe propped across one shoulder, with a haft nearly as long as he was tall. The Ogier made the bearded man look jolly. The ships on the Elguenya had all their lanterns lit, including the seafolk ship, that occasioned so much rumor for being in Carrion at all, for remaining at anchor so long with barely any contact with the shore. By the rumors Perrin had heard, the seafolk disapproved of the carrying on in the city even more than the Aiel did, and he had thought Gaul would die from shock at all the men and women kissing. Whether or not the woman wore a blouse did not appear to bother Gaul nearly as much as the fact that they were kissing where they could be seen. That was indecent. Long stone piers thrust out into the river between tall flanking walls, and boats of all sizes and types were tied along them, including ferries that could take 1 horse or 50, but Perrin did not see more than one man on any of them. He reined in the bay as he came to a broad mastless craft, some 6 or 7 spans long, lashed to stone posts. Its ramp to the dock was in place. A stout gray-haired man with no shirt was sitting on an appended cask on the deck. A gray-haired woman, with 6 bright slashes across the bosom of her dark dress, on his knees.
"We want to cross," Perrin said loudly, trying to look only enough to see whether the pair took their arms from around each other. They did not. Perrin tossed an Andoran crown down into the ferry, and the sound of the fat gold coin bouncing on the deck brought the fellow's head around.
"We want to cross," Perrin said, hefting a 2nd gold crown on his palm. After a moment, he added another. The ferryman licked his lips. "I will have to find oarsmen," he muttered, staring at Perrin's hand. Sighing, Perrin pulled 2 more from his purse. He could remember when his eyes would have fallen out at having one of those coins. The ferryman leaped up, dropping the noblewoman onto her bottom with a thump, and scrambled up the ramp, panting that he would be only moments, my lord, only moments. The woman gave Perrin a very reproachful look and glided away down the dock with a dignity somewhat spoiled by rubbing herself. Before she had gone very far, though, she gathered her skirts and ran to join a group of dancers capering along the waterfront. Perrin could hear her laughing. It took more than moments, but apparently the promise of gold was enough, for in not too long a time the ferryman had enough fellows gathered to man most of the long sweeps. Perrin stood stroking the bay's nose as the vessel swung out into the river. He had not decided on a name yet. The animal came from the Sun Palace stable. Well shod, with white forefeet, the horse looked a stayer, though not a patch on stepper. His unstrung Two Rivers bow was thrust through the saddle girth on one side, and the full quiver hung in front of the high-cantled saddle, balancing a long, narrow, neatly wrapped bundle. Rand's sword. Fael had tied that package herself and handed it to him without a word. She had said something after he had turned away, realizing he would receive no kiss.
"If you fall," she whispered, "I will take up your sword."
He was still not sure whether she meant him to hear or not. Her scent had been such a jumble, he could make nothing out. He knew he should be thinking of what he was about, but Fael always crept softly back into his mind. At one point he had been sure she was about to announce that she was coming with him,
and his heart had clenched. Had she done so, he did not think he could have made himself refuse her. Not that or anything, after all the hurt he had given her. But there were six Aes Sedai ahead, and blood and death. If Fael died, Perrin knew he would go mad. That point had come when Berlane said she would be leading her Maenor-winged guards in this chase. Luckily, the moment had been gotten past quickly, if in an odd way.
"If you leave the city Randall Thor has given to you as his hand," Ruark said quietly, "how many rumors will grow of it? If you send all of your spears, how many rumors? What will grow from these tales?"
It sounded like advice, and then again it did not. Something in the clan chief's voice made it much stronger. Berlane gazed at him, smelling stubborn and head high. Slowly the stubborn smell faded, and she muttered to herself,
"Sometimes I think there are too many men who can—"
It was just audible to Perrin. Smiling, she spoke aloud in a remarkably regal tone.
"That is sound advice, Ruark. I think that I will take it."
The most remarkable thing, however, had been the way their scents combined, Ruark's and hers. To Perrin they had seemed he-wolf and near-grown cub, an indulgent father, fond of his daughter and she of him, though sometimes he still had to nip her nose to make her behave properly. But what was important was that Perrin could see the intention fading from Fael's eyes. What was he to do? If he lived to see her again, what was he to do? In the beginning, the coarsely dressed, sometimes bare-chested oarsmen made rough jokes, not too unfriendly, about how any amount of gold was hardly worth what they were missing. They laughed as they strode back and forth along the deck, working the sweeps, and everyone claimed he had been dancing with or kissing a noblewoman. One lanky fellow with a big chin even claimed he had a Tyran noblewoman on his knee before he came out to Manal's shout, but no one believed that. Perrin certainly did not. The Tyran men had taken one look at what was going on and dived headfirst into the celebrations. The Tyran women had taken one look and shut themselves up in their rooms with guards on the doors. Jokes and laughter did not last long. Gaul stood as near the center of the boat as he could, slightly wild eyes fixed on the far shore, up on his toes as though ready to leap. It was all that water, of course, but the boatman could not know that. And Loyal, leaning on the long-handled axe he had found in the Sun Palace, with its ornately engraved head like the head of a huge wood axe, stood still as a statue with his broad face truly looking carved from granite. The ferrymen shut their mouths and worked their oars as hard as they could, hardly daring to look at their passengers. When the ferry finally pulled into a stone dock on the west bank of the Alguenia, Perrin gave the owner, come to think of it, he hoped the man was the owner, the rest of the gold and a handful of silver to pass around besides, to soothe them for being frightened by Loyal and Gaul. The fat man flinched back from him in taking it, and bowed so deeply in spite of his bulk that his head nearly touched his knees. Perhaps Gaul and Loyal did not have the only frightening faces. Huge windowless buildings stood surrounded by wooden scaffolding, the stone blackened and fallen in many places. The granaries had been burned in riots some time ago, and repairs were only now really taking hold. But there was no one in sight at all on the streets lined with granaries and stables, warehouses and wagon yards. Every last man who worked here was in the city. There was no one in sight until two men rode out of a side street.
"We are ready, Lord Ibarra," Javier Nerella said eagerly.
The pink-cheeked young man, considerably taller than his companion, appeared gaudy in his red-painted breastplate and helmet, with a single slender red plume. He even smelled eager. And young.
"I began to think you were not coming," Dobrain muttered. Helmetless, he wore steel-backed gauntlets and a battered breastplate that retained remnants of once ornate gilding. He glanced at Perrin's face and added, "Under the light I meant no disrespect, Lord Ibarra."
"'We have a long way to go,' Perrin said, turning the bay.
"'Stair? What was he to do about Fail?"
Rand's need seethed beneath his skin. "'They've 4 days on us now.' He dug in his heels lightly and put Stair to a steady walk. A long chase it would not do to founder the horses. Neither Loyal nor Gaul had any difficulty keeping up. The widest of the straight streets abruptly became the Tarvalen Road. Kyrian's Tarvalen Road. There were others. A wide band of hard-packed earth winding west and north through forested hills lower than those the city stood on. A mile into the forest they were joined by 200 Maenor-winged guards and 500 armsmen of House Taberwin, all mounted on the best animals that could be found. The Maenors were all in red breastplates and helmets like rimmed pots that covered the nape of the neck, and their lances bore red streamers. Many of them seemed almost as eager as Nerella. The shorter Kyrianen wore plain breastplates and helmets like bells cut away to expose hard faces, helmets and breastplates alike often dented. Their lances were unadorned, though here and there Dobrain's Khan, a small stiff square on a short staff, blue with 2 white diamonds, marked officers or minor lords of House Taberwin. None of them looked eager, only grim. They had seen fighting. In Kyrian they called it seeing the wolf. That nearly made Perrin laugh. It was not time for the wolves yet. Near midday, a small cluster of Aiel trotted out of the trees and down the slope to the road. 2 maidens loped at Ruark's shoulder, Nandera and, Perrin realized after a moment, Sulin. She looked very different in Cadensor, with her white hair cut close except for the tail at the back of her neck. She looked natural, which she never had in livery. Amis and Soralia came with them, shawls looped over their arms, clattering with necklaces and bracelets of gold and ivory, holding up their bulky skirts on the slope, but matching the others stride for stride. Perrin swung down to walk with them, ahead of everyone else. "How many?" was all he said. Ruark glanced back to where Gaul and Loyal were walking alongside Dobrain and Nerella in advance of the column. Too far maybe for even Perrin to hear anything over the clump of hooves and jingle of bridles and creak of saddles, but Ruark held his voice low anyway.
5,000 men from different societies. A few more than 5. I could not bring many. Timolin was suspicious as it is that I did not go with him against the Shido. If it becomes common knowledge that Aes Sedai hold the Karakarn, I fear the bleakness will swallow us all.
Nandera and Sulin coughed loudly at the same time. The 2 women glared at one another, and after a moment Sulin looked away, blushing. Ruark spared them a glance. He smelled exasperated and muttered,
I also have nearly 1,000 maidens. Had I not tightened my fist, I would have every last one of them running after me, carrying a torch to tell the world that Randall Thor is in danger.
Abruptly his voice hardened.
Any maiden I find following us will learn that I mean what I say.
Sulin and Andera both went red, the color startling on those hard sun-dark faces. Both began at the same instant. Again those glares passed, and again Sulin looked away, her face even more crimson. Perrin did not remember all this blushing from Bane and Chiad, the only 2 maidens he really knew.
I have promised, Nandera said stiffly, and every maiden has promised on pledge. It will be as the chief has commanded.
Perrin forbore asking what the bleakness was, just as he did not ask how Ruark had gotten the Aiel across the Alguenia without ferries, when water they could not step across was the only thing in the world that could give an Aiel pause. He would have liked to know, but the answers were unimportant. 6,000 Aiel, 500 of Dobrain's armsmen, and 200 winged guards. Against 6 Aes Sedai, their warders, and some 500 guards, apparently. That should be enough. Except the Aes Sedai held Rand. If they put a knife to his throat,
Would anyone dare lift a hand?
There are also 94 wise ones, Amis said. They are the strongest in the one power of those near the city.
That came out reluctantly. He had the idea Aiel women did not like to admit they could channel, but her voice picked up.
We would not have brought so many, but all wanted to come.
Soralea cleared her throat, and this time Amis blushed.
He was going to have to ask Gaul. Aiel were so unlike anyone else he had ever met. Maybe they began blushing when they grew older.
Soralea leads us,
Amis finished, and the older woman gave a snort that sounded extremely satisfied. She certainly smelled satisfied. For Perrin, he only just stopped from shaking his head. What he knew of the One Power could be stuffed into a thimble with room left for a fat thumb. But he had traveled with Moraine, seen what Varen and Alana could do, and he had seen that flame Soralea had made. If she was one of the strongest in the power among the Wise Ones, he was not sure six Aes Sedai would not wrap all 94 of them into a bundle. At this point, though, he would not have turned aside field mice.
They must be 70 or 80 miles ahead of us, he said. Maybe as much as 100 if they're pushing their wagons. We will have to press as hard as we can.
As he climbed back to his saddle, Ruark and the other Aiel were already trotting back up the hill. Perrin raised his hand, and Dobrain signaled the horsemen to advance. It never occurred to Perrin to wonder why men old enough to be his father, women old enough to be his mother, men and women used to command, were following him. What he did wonder about, worry about, was how fast they could move. Aiel and Karansor could keep up with the horses, he knew. Yet at first he had worried about wise ones in skirts, some maybe as old as Soralea. Skirts or no, white hair or no, the wise ones walked as quickly as anyone, keeping up with the horses while talking quietly in groups. The road wound clear ahead. No one set out during the Feast of Lights, and few for days before, unless their business was as urgent as his. The sun climbed higher, and the hills grew lower, and by the time they made camp at twilight, he estimated they might have come as much as 35 miles. A good day's travel, excellent for so large a party, half again what the Aes Sedai could manage unless they were willing to kill the teams drawing their wagons. He no longer worried whether he could catch them before they reached Tarvalen, only what he could do once he did. Lying on his blankets, with his head pillowed on his saddle, Perrin smiled up at the waxing quarter moon. With any clouds at all, the night would not have been nearly so bright. It was a good night for hunting. A good night for wolves. In his mind, he formed an image. A curly-haired young wild bull, proud, with horns that gleamed like polished metal in morning sunlight. His thumb ran across the axe lying beside him, with its wicked, curving blade and sharp spike. The steel horns of Young Bull. That was what the wolves called him. He let his mind quest, sent the image out into the night. There would be wolves, and they would know of Young Bull. News of a human able to speak with wolves would pass across the land like a rushing wind. Perrin had only met two. One, a friend, the other, a poor wretch who had not been able to hold on to humanity. He had heard tales from the refugees who trickled into the Two Rivers. They had old stories of men turning into wolves, stories few really believed, told to entertain children. Three claimed to have known men who became wolves and ran wild, though. And if the details had seemed wrong to Perrin, the uneasy way two of them had avoided his yellow eyes made confirmation of a sort. Those two, a woman from Taraban and a man from Almuth Plain, would not go outdoors at night. They also kept giving him gifts of garlic for some reason, which he ate with great pleasure. But he no longer tried to find others like himself. He felt wolves, and their names began coming to him. Two Moons, and Wildfire, and Old Deer, and dozens more cascading into his head.
They were not names as such, really, but images and sensations. Young Bull was a very simple image to name a wolf. Two Moons was really a night-shrouded pool, smooth as ice in the instant before the breeze stirred, with a tang of autumn in the air, and one moon hanging full in the sky, and another reflected so perfectly on the water that it was difficult to tell which was real. And that was cutting it to the bone. For a time, there was only the exchanging of names and scents. Then he thought, I seek people who are ahead of me, Aes Sedai and men, with horses and wagons. That was not exactly what he thought, of course, any more than Two Moons was just Two Moons. People were two legs and horses hard-footed forelegs. Aes Sedai were two-legged shes who touch the wind that moves the sun and call fire. Wolves did not like fire, and they were even more wary of Aes Sedai than of other humans. They thought it amazing that he could not tell an Aes Sedai. He had only learned they could by chance. They took the ability as much for granted as he took being able to pick out one white horse among a herd of black. Certainly nothing to mention, and certainly nothing they could explain clearly. In his head, the night sky seemed to whirl, suddenly capping a camp of wagons and tents and campfires. They did not look quite right. Wolves cared little for anything human, so the wagons and tents seemed vague. The campfires appeared to roar dangerously. The horses looked quite tasty, and this was passed from wolf to wolf before reaching him. The camp was larger than Perrin expected, but Wildfire was in no doubt. Her pack was even then skirting wide of where the two-legged shes who touch the wind that moves the sun and call fire were. Perrin tried asking how many, but wolves had no grasp of numbers. They told how many things there were by showing how many they had seen, and once Wildfire and her pack sensed Aes Sedai, they had no intention of going any closer. How far received a better answer, again passed wolf to wolf, if one that had to be puzzled out. Wildfire said she could walk to the hill where a sour male named Halftail had his pack feeding on a deer while the moon moved so far across the sky at that angle. Halftail could reach Rabbit Nose, apparently a young and very fierce male, while the moon moved that far at another angle. And so it went until Two Moons was reached. Two Moons maintained a dignified silence, suitable for an old male with a muzzle more white than not. He and his pack were not much beyond a mile from Perrin, and it would have been insulting to think Perrin did not know exactly where they sat. Reasoning it out as best he could, Perrin came up with a figure of 60 or 70 miles. Tomorrow, he would be able to tell how fast he was closing on them. They surely could not be moving as fast as he with wagons.
Why?
That was Halftail, passed along and scent-marked. Perrin hesitated before answering. He had dreaded this. He felt about the wolves as he did about Two Rivers people.
They have caged Shadow Killer, he thought at last.
That was what the wolves called Rand, but he had no idea whether they considered Rand important. The shock filling his mind was answer enough, but howls filled the night, near and far, howls filled with anger and fear. In the camp, horses whinnied fearfully, stamping their hooves as they shied against the picket ropes. Men ran to calm them, and others to peer into the darkness, as if expecting a huge pack to come after the mounts.
We come, Halftail replied at last.
Only that, and then others answered. Packs Perrin had spoken to, and packs that had listened silently to the two legs who could speak as the wolves did.
We come.
No more. Rolling over, Perrin went to sleep and dreamed he was a wolf running across endless hills. The next morning there was no sign of wolves, not even the Aiel reported seeing one, but Perrin could feel them, several hundred of them, and more on the way. The land flattened into rolling plains over the next 4 days, where the tallest rises hardly seemed to warrant the name hill compared to what had been around them back by the Aguena.
The forest thinned and faded into grassland, brown and sere, with thickets increasingly far between. The rivers and streams they crossed barely wet the horses' hooves, and would not have done much more before they had narrowed between banks of sun-hardened mud and stones. Each night the wolves told Perrin what they could of the Aes Sedai ahead, which was not much. Wildfires packed shadowed, but well back. One thing did become clear. Perrin was covering as much ground each day as he had the first, and each day he sliced as much as 10 miles from the Aes Sedai lead. But when he caught up, what then? Before the wolves each night, Perrin would sit talking quietly with Loyal, as they smoked their pipes together. It was the what then that Perrin wanted to talk about. Dobrain seemed to think they should charge in and die doing their best. Ruark only said that they must wait to see what the sun shone on tomorrow, and that all men must wake from the dream, which was not so different from Dobrain. Loyal might be a young Ogier, but he was still 90-odd. Perrin suspected Loyal had read more books than he himself had seen, and he often came out with surprising knowledge about Aes Sedai.
There are several books about Aes Sedai dealing with men who can channel.
Loyal frowned around his pipe. Its leaf-carved bowl was as big as Perrin's two fists.
Elora, daughter of Amar, daughter of Kura, wrote Men of Fire and Women of Air in the early days of Otter Hawkwing's reign. And Ladar, son of Shandin, son of Koimal, wrote A Study of Men, Women, and the One Power Among Humans only some 300 years ago. Those are the two best, I think. Elora in particular. She wrote in the style of... No, I will be brief.
Perrin doubted that. Brevity was seldom numbered among Loyal's virtues when he spoke of books. The Ogier cleared his throat.
By Tower law, the man must be taken to the Tower for trial before he can be gentled.
For a moment, Loyal's ears twitched violently, and his long eyebrows drew down grimly, but he patted Perrin's shoulder in an effort at comfort.
I cannot think they mean to do that, Perrin. I hear they spoke of honoring him, and he is the dragon reborn. They know that.
Honor? Perrin said quietly. Maybe they're letting him sleep on silk, but a prisoner is still a prisoner.
I am sure they are treating him well, Perrin. I am sure.
The Ogier did not sound sure, and his sigh was a hollow gale.
And he is safe until he does reach Tarvalen. What I do not understand is how they captured him.
That huge head swung in open puzzlement.
Perrin, both Elora and Ladar say that when Aes Sedai find a man of great power, they always gather 13 to take him. Oh, they recount stories of 4 or 5, and both mention Corrigan. She brought a man nearly 2,000 miles to the tower by herself, after he killed both of her warders. But, Perrin, they wrote of Urien Stonebow and Gwera Malison, of Rowland Darkspain and Davian as well. But the others are who worry me.
Those were 4 of the most powerful among the men who had called themselves the Dragon Reborn, all long ago, before Arthur Hawkwing.
6 Aes Sedai tried to capture Stonebow, and he killed 3 and captured the others himself. 6 tried to take Amalison. He killed 1 and stilled 2 more. Surely Rand is as strong as Stonebow or Amalison. Are there really only 6 ahead of us? It would explain much.
Perhaps it did, but no comfort in it. 13 Aes Sedai might be able to beat off any attack Perrin could mount by themselves without their warders and guards. 13 Aes Sedai could threaten to still Rand if Perrin attacked. Surely they would not. They did know Rand was the Dragon Reborn. They knew he had to be there at the last battle. But could Perrin risk it? Tower law or no tower law? Who knew why Aes Sedai did anything? He had never been able to make himself trust even Aes Sedai, who had tried to show themselves friends. They had always held their secrets, and how could a man ever be sure when he could feel them moving behind his back, however much they smiled to his face?
Who could say what Aes Sedai would do? In truth, Loyal did not know much that would help when the day came, and besides, he was much more interested in talking about Aerith. Perrin knew he had left two letters with Fael, one addressed to his mother and the other to Aerith, to be delivered when she could, if anything untoward should happen. Which Loyal had nearly bent over backward trying to assure her would not happen. He always worried terribly about worrying anyone else. Perrin had left his own letter for Fael. Amys had carried it out to the Wise Ones in the Aiel camp.
"She is so beautiful,"
Loyal murmured, staring at the night as if seeing her.
"Her face is so delicate, yet strong at the same time. When I looked at her eyes, it seemed I could see nothing else. And her ears."
Abruptly, his own ears were vibrating wildly, and he choked on his pipe.
"Please," he gasped, "forget I mentioned. I should not have spoken of. You know I am not coarse, Perrin."
"I've forgotten already," Perrin said weakly. "Her ears?" Loyal wanted to know what it was like being married. Not that he had any intention of marrying yet, he was quick to add. He was too young, and he had his book to finish, and he was not ready to settle down to a life of never leaving the steading except to visit another, which a wife would assuredly insist on. He was just curious, no more than that. So Perrin spoke of life with Fael, how she had transplanted his roots before he knew it. Once the Two Rivers had been home, now home was wherever Fael was. The thought that she was waiting quickened his step. Her presence brightened a room, and at her smile every trouble receded. Of course, he could not speak of how thinking of her made his blood leap, or looking at her, his heart pound. It would not have been decent, and he certainly had no intention of mentioning the trouble she had planted in his bones. What was he to do? He really was ready to go on his knees to her, but a stubborn iron seed in him required that one word from her first. If only she would just say she wanted things to be as they had been.
"What about her jealousy?"
Loyal asked, and it was Perrin's turn to choke.
"Are wives all like that?"
"Jealousy?" Perrin said stoutly. "Fael is not jealous. Where did you get that idea? She is perfect."
"Of course she is,"
Loyal said faintly, peering into his pipe bowl.
"Do you have any more Two Rivers to buck? All I have after this is some sharp Kyrianin leaf."
Had it all been like that, the journey would have been peaceful in a way, as much as such a chase could be. The land rolled by without another soul in sight. If the sun was molten gold, turning the air to an oven, hawks often wheeled in the cloudless blue sky. The wolves, not wanting humans coming out where they were, drove deer toward the road in such numbers that there were more than even such a large group needed, and it was not unusual to see a proud buck with a tall forked rack and his does and a few spike horns standing in plain sight as the column passed. But there was an old saying, "The only man completely at peace is a man without a navel." The Kyrianin were not easy with the Aiel, of course, frequently frowning at them or sneering openly. More than once Dobrain muttered about being outnumbered 12-1. He respected their fighting abilities, but in the way you respected the dangerous qualities of a pack of rabid leopards. The Aiel did not glare or sneer, they just made it plain the Kyrianin were beneath notice. Perrin would not have been surprised to see one of them try to walk through a Kyrianin for refusing to admit he was there. Ruark said there would be no trouble, so long as the tree killers started none. Dobrain said there would be no trouble so long as the savages kept out of his way. Perrin wished he could be certain they would not start killing one another before they even saw the Aes Sedai holding Rand. He had some hope the Maenners might be a bridge between the two, though at times he found himself regretting it. The men in red breastplates got on well with the shorter men in plain armor. There had never been a war between Maen and Kyrian. And the Maenners also got on with the Aiel. Except for the Aiel War, Maenners had never fought Aiel. Dobrain was quite friendly with Nerella, often sharing the evening meal,
and Yorella took to smoking a pipe with various of the Aiel, especially Gaul. That was where the regret came from. "I have been talking with Gaul," Yorella said diffidently. It was the fourth day on the road, and he had come up from the Mayenners to ride beside Perrin at the head of the column. Perrin was only half listening. Wildfire had allowed one of the younger males in her pack to creep close soon after the Aes Sedai began moving that morning, and he had not smelled Rand. Every wolf knew the scent of Shadowkiller, it seemed. Still, for all the sketchiness of what morning clouds had seen, every wagon but one appeared to have a canvas cover on hoops. Rand was probably inside one of the others, and a good deal more comfortable out of the sun than Perrin was, with sweat rolling down his neck.
"He was telling me of the Battle of Emmons Field," Narella went on, "and your Two Rivers campaign, Lord Ibarra. It would honor me greatly to hear of your battles from yourself."
Abruptly, Perrin sat up stiff in his saddle, staring at the boy. No, not a boy, despite those pink cheeks and that open face. Narella was surely as old as he himself, but the man's scent, all bright and quivering slightly, Perrin very nearly groaned. He had smelled that from young boys back home, but to be hero-worshipped by a man his own age was almost more than he could take. If that had been the worst of it, though, he would hardly have minded. He expected the Aiel and the Cariena not to like one another. He should have expected a young man who had never seen a battle to look up to one who had fought Trollocs. It was the things he could not have foreseen that frayed his nerves. The unforeseen could bite you on the ankle when you least expected it, and could least afford to be distracted. Except for Gaul and Ruark, every Aielman wore a strip of crimson cloth tied around his temples with that black-and-white disc above his brows. Perrin had seen them in Carrion and in Camelin. But now, when he asked Gaul, and then Ruark, if that marked them as this Siswayaman Ruark had spoken of, both men tried to pretend they did not know what he was talking about, as if they could not see red headbands on 5,000 men. Perrin even asked the man who seemed to be in charge under Ruark, Urien, a two-spires rain, whom Perrin had met long ago, but Urien seemed not to understand either. Well, Ruark had said he could only bring Siswayaman, so that was how Perrin thought of them, even if he did not know what it meant. What he did know was there might be trouble between Siswayaman and the maidens. When some of those men looked at the maidens, Perrin caught a whiff of jealousy. When some of the maidens looked at the Siswayaman, their scent made him think of a wolf hunkering over the carcass of a deer, not meaning to let any other of the pack have a bite if she choked to death swallowing it all. He could not begin to fathom why, but there it was, and sharp. That was a maybe, though, some time to come. Other things were not. For the first 2 days after leaving the city, Sulin and Andera both put themselves forward whenever Ruark said anything concerning the maidens. Every time Sulin backed away, blushing, but she was right there the next time, every time. The second evening, when camp was made, they tried to kill each other with their bare hands. At least, that was what it looked like to Perrin, kicking each other, hitting with fists, tossing each other to the ground, bending arms so that he was sure bones must break, until whoever was at a disadvantage managed to free herself with a twist or a blow. Ruark stopped him when he tried to interfere and looked surprised that he wanted to. A good many of the Cariennan and Mayenners gathered around to watch and place bets, but no Aiel so much as glanced at the fight, not even the wise ones. Finally, Sulin had Nandera face down with an arm doubled painfully behind her. Seizing Nandera's hair, she slammed the other woman's head against the ground until she lay limp. For a long time, the older woman stood looking down at the one she had beaten. Then Sulin heaved the unconscious Nandera up onto her shoulders and staggered away with her. Perrin assumed that Sulin would do the talking from then on, but such was not the case at all. She was still always there, but a bruised Nandera answered Ruark's questions and took his commands, while an equally bruised Sulin kept silent, and when Nandera asked Sulin to do something, she did it without hesitation. Perrin could only scratch his head and wonder whether he had actually seen the fight end as he thought it had. The wise ones always walked alongside the road in groups that varied in size and seemed to shift members constantly. By the end of the first day, Perrin realized that all that shifting really centered around two women, Soralea and Amis. By the end of the second, he was sure the two were urging very different viewpoints. There were too many glares and frowns. Now and then, Perrin heard Aes Sedai mentioned. He caught snatches about custom and battle, but never enough to understand. Amis began backing down more slowly and blushing considerably less. Sometimes Ruark smelled faintly anxious when he looked at his wife, but that was the only sign he saw anything. By the third camp out of the city, Perrin half expected to see Sulin and Andera's fight repeated between wise ones. Instead, the two women took a water skin and went off a little distance, where they sat by themselves on the ground and removed their folded scarves so their long hair hung loose. He watched them into moonlit darkness, keeping far enough back that he would not eavesdrop even by accident, until he went to his own bed, but all they did was drink cups of water and talk. The next morning, the rest of the wise ones still shifted from group to group, but before the long column had covered 3 miles, Perrin realized that all centered on Soralea now. Now and then she and Amis went off to one side of the road by themselves to talk, but there were no more glares. Had they been wolves, Perrin would have said a challenge to the pack leader had been defeated. But by their sense, Soralea accepted Amis almost as an equal now, which did not fit wolves at all. The seventh day out of Kyrian, riding